pertains to us, and we do have to wrap up fairly punctually at about 4:25. And there'll be some concluding announcements as well. Let's really reflect or question, pose questions. I'm going to privilege those who haven't yet spoken. Over here. Yes, this lady and then that lady. Well, I made a decision when I was, before starting today, that I was not going to mention the 9/11. And I stuck to it. I do think that we need, one of the great challenges for this, or any real practice, is to balance our own spiritual, for lack of a better word, needs, and to engage with the realities of the world we live in today. And certainly the whole notion of secularity would be one that would, you know, give considerable importance to not thinking of our practice as something cut off from or something totally private that we do when we meditate, but our practice is something that embraces the whole of our lives. But it also, I think, has a lot to do with becoming aware of the extent to which we are driven and conditioned by, let's say, social or political circumstances to feel or behave in a certain way, when actually deep down we know that's not going to be terribly helpful. So I think we do need to find an autonomy within our practice. In other words, a growing recognition of what our actual needs are, both personally and socially, at a given time, and not to feel that we have to do X because that's somehow expected of us in our society. But on the other hand, I do think that these larger issues are very important to address. And I'd rather not get into anything to do with the 9/11 thing. I think that's for all of us to come to terms with in our own way. Yes. Okay.
You spoke about confidence as one of the factors.
Yes. Yeah, well, the word in Pali is sadda, which is usually translated as faith, and that's not inaccurate. But the trouble with the word faith is it carries a lot of religious baggage, unavoidably. So I prefer to put that word aside and think in terms of confidence. And what we have confidence in is in our own capacity to transcend our limitations. In other words, our own capacity to not react or respond to circumstances because of attachment or fear or what others expect of us or our dislikes or opinions, but have the confidence to be open and present to what is occurring and to seek to respond to that from what we might call wisdom or love, compassion, that's really heartfelt. So it's a confidence to live from one's own heartfelt core of one's life, which I think that awareness and mindfulness open up a space within us, let's say, a quiet and stiller space in which we can become more attuned to our deepest intuitions and values. And each occasion in life, like the business with 9/11 celebration, is something that we respond to, we relate to, from that source within ourselves, that depth within ourselves. And that we have the confidence that, you know, we can do that. And confidence, I think, is something that isn't just a given. It's something that we can cultivate and develop. We can, through our practice, our lives, become more confident in our own capacity. But we only will gain confidence by actually acting sometimes in ways that are risky and uncertain. It's the courage to go beyond habit, to go beyond social pressure, for example. There's in the Milinda Panha, have you heard of this text? The Questions of King Milinda. There you find a very interesting analogy for sadha, confidence. He compares, the monk in this discourse compares it to courage, basically. And he says that, he gives an image, he says, imagine a lot of people on a riverbank, and none of them have the courage to jump over. And then a person comes along and leaps across the river, and thereby gives others the confidence that they can do it too. Now, curiously, although Melinda Panna had never heard of Søren Kierkegaard, this, of course, is the leap of faith, if you wish. And so we are inspired by others. I think that's very important. It's not just a purely private matter. But we may be inspired by others, but do we have the confidence in ourselves to follow those actions and to make those leaps ourselves? So we don't have faith in God or faith in the Buddha. And as soon as you use the word faith, you can't avoid, almost in the next words, saying faith in something greater than ourselves. Confidence really has to do with our own ability to take risks and to find the courage within ourselves to act differently. And that, I feel, is an integral part of this process. Ooh, lots of hands. Yes.
I'm not actually a Buddhist, a Christian with an Indian, I'm Indian teacher, but I have been practicing Buddhist meditation recently. And you don't know, one observation, I just put it out to you, you don't really notice it so much in my experience of Eastern Buddhists, but Western Buddhists seem to be a little bit serious. There seems to be a lack of sense of humour and fun and joy in Western Buddhism, is my general observation. Surely fun, humour, joy is very much a part of this life, and I don't think it's something the Buddha teaches, but it does seem to get awfully serious in Western Buddhism, and I just wanted to put that out to you. That's just a very initial observation. I can't say that I'm right about this, but
I think in some respects you are right, actually. And I think it's a problem that confronts converts of any faith. I believe. I think if you grow up in a religion, you're somehow held and nurtured by it in such a way that it becomes almost a part of you. When you convert to religion, you're actually doing something quite drastic. You're often doing it because of some very, you know, pressing, serious, and probably painful need. And embracing another faith, another tradition, a non-European, non-Western tradition, is somewhat stepping outside of the bounds of what, you know, for example, my mother or others would ever have expected. But I think it is also something that you are far more self-conscious of being a Buddhist than you would be, say, if you were simply pursuing your life as a Christian or whatever, had you been born in it. And it's true, I've noticed in Asia particularly, that natural-born Buddhists tend to take Buddhism a lot more lightly than converts like myself. I agree with you. But I think the reasons have not to do with Buddhism, have to do with basically the issues around conversion. I suspect Westerners who convert to Islam are very terribly serious too.
I actually noticed something because I was practicing 2 hours meditation a day and everything. It was like suddenly I really wanted to go to church and have my half an hour of ceremony mm-hmm. and that whole. It's not that I believe in it, but it was just like a thirst for that.
Yeah.
I think there is a natural thirst for some sort of ceremony. I mean, humans love ceremony somehow or other. So I wonder where you fit that in with your sort of non.
Well, to be quite honest, what we've been doing today is basically a ritual.
Yeah.
We've been sitting still for 40 minutes, 30 minutes. That is a ritual. And it's a ceremony, if you wish. It's something we choose to do together. It's sitting, you know, something we wouldn't otherwise do. And I find those needs that you might find in the church met. I love sitting quietly together in a room. A Quaker service would not be noticeably different, in fact, except you wouldn't have someone on a podium telling you what's what. Thank you. Let's go back in the room. Yes, this gentleman with the little white beard, and then the chap with the little brown beard.
Thank you very much for what I found a fascinating talk. At one point, you said, I think, that in this way of thinking, mindfulness is not just a spiritual practice, mm-hmm. but a way into a more ethical way mm-hmm. of being. I was left wondering whether it was a spiritual practice at all. And what that might mean.
Well, I mean, there's a big problem around the word spiritual. Please tell me what it means. It's a very difficult word to define. And I think we often use it because we don't like the word religious. So we use the word spiritual as a sort of substitute. I'd like to imagine a discourse in which we didn't need to use that word. And I find myself using it in spite of myself. Let me rephrase what I said. I don't know whether I said, I don't know what I can't remember now. Mindfulness is certainly a necessary element of a contemplative practice. How contemplative, in other words, reflective, stilling of the mind, focusing of attention. Mindfulness is really rather important, whether you call it mindfulness or not. You need that quality of attention to keep the mind focused and alert and present. It's also an integral part of ethical behavior. In the sense that, and this is not a new idea, this is when I first studied mindfulness, it was in a Mahayana work called the Bodhicaryavatara by Shantideva. And for Shantideva, he's living about the 8th century AD, about 1,000 years after the Buddha. Mindfulness is quite explicitly an integral part of the practice of ethics and morality. Because mindfulness is to remember what you value. Mm-hmm. Remember, mindfulness is, again, a slight mistranslation. The word in Pali is sati, or in Sanskrit, smriti, which means to remember. So to be mindful of your breathing basically means to remember that you're breathing. To be mindful of impermanence, let's say, is to remember that things are impermanent. To be mindful of your values is to remember what it is that you value most deeply. It's to keep in mind, to be mindful of these things. So it's a much broader quality, at least in Buddhist tradition, than it is sometimes presented in a more secularized version, which it becomes quite narrowly defined as a particular mental skill to help resolve a particular pathological problem. But in the broader sense, mindfulness extends through meditation, through morals, through philosophy, through the practice of life itself. Yes, gentleman at the back with the glasses and the brown beard.
Yeah, you said that you could phrase the four truths as four tasks.
Yes.
So how would you phrase those exactly?
It boils down to an acronym I've come up with called ELSA. Embrace dukkha, let go of craving, experience stopping, and cultivate a path. Now, ELSA would be embrace, let go, stop, act. I think you can boil it down to that. Now, again, I'm not making this up. If you read the Buddha's first sermon, this is exactly how it concludes. Dukkha is to be fully known. Craving is to be let go of. Nibbana, or the stopping of craving, is to be experienced. And the path is to be brought into being, which means to be created and cultivated. So each of the truths is quite explicitly presented as something, as an action to be performed. But strangely, this is a teaching that, although it's enshrined in one of the most fundamental Buddhist texts there is, the first sermon, is not developed, as far as I'm aware, by any Buddhist school, historically. You just don't find that particular fourfold formulation very prominent in Buddhist texts. You find it here and there. So basically, it's embrace the situation you're in, let go of your habitual reactive response, stop being caught up in all of that, and act. Say something, do something, or don't do something. So it actually works very neatly. Yes?
So a kind of one and two sort of combined there in embracing.
Well, they're all combined. I mean, if you, in a sense, you can boil it down to a single moment. And again, as I mentioned, I mean, you may have picked this up. I mean, the way the Buddha defines fully knowing dukkha is identical to the way he defines stopping craving. In both cases, he uses the same phrase, raga-kayo, dosa-kayo, moha-kayo. Ending greed, ending hatred, ending confusion. So clearly, he's not talking about four utterly discrete things. Any kind of action, any kind of task you perform will include a range of elements. And what the Buddha's doing, I think, with the four truths is he's basically parsing what in fact is what we otherwise call our practice into these into these different facets. That's how I'd see it. Yes, the lady there with the funny purplish kind of scarf. Right there. And then the chap behind you, yes.
In terms of them,
so you have to speak up a bit, I can't.
Okay, when you're going to teachings from monks or teachers or whatever about Buddhism, mm. And you're trying to look at it from a secular point of view rather than a religious point of view, is it more a question of interpretation? So if you're thinking of doing analytical.
Uh huh, okay. To some extent, yes. I mean, I think it's quite legitimate when you, let's say, go to hear a Buddhist teacher, you go to hear the Dalai Lama or you go and hear some Theravada monk. It would be a rather sorry situation if you felt that you just had to passively absorb what that person was saying and then try to live up to it. We're always, I think, unavoidably going to be selective in what we gain from such a teaching. And that selectivity will be driven by our own values, our own self-identity, our own longings. And so I think it's perfectly unavoidable, really, that, let's say, with the idea of emptiness, which is a wonderfully non-religious idea, frankly, it's entirely compatible with a, you don't have to believe anything. So I do think, to me, what constitute the really distinctive core teachings of the Buddha do not require any leap of religious type faith. But you'll find often in classical Buddhist teaching that these rather sort of straightforward ideas and teachings are often mixed up with a lot of metaphysics that is very difficult to take at face value. You either have to take a leap of faith, like, for example, the idea of rebirth or whatever in different realms of existence. You can either say, well, that must be true because the Lama's enlightened, therefore it must be me who's stupid. Or you can say, well, actually, that's the language of ancient India and Tibet. Nowadays, we'd interpret that in a different way. It's really talking about states of mind or whatever. Or you might say, this is a language that no longer speaks to me. I'm going to put that to one side. Yes, at the back.
I appreciate what you were saying about belief being put to one side in a way that puts religion to that side as well. And action is something separate that leads beyond that. But I'm just wondering, at the end of that process, does spirituality come back in? Because you use the word in spite of yourself is born, which is mystical, which I think is interesting. And I was listening to someone talk about Buddhism and God yesterday, who said that her God-shaped hole was filled by the search for enlightenment. And that was a word that you haven't used so much today either. So I'm just wondering, is the enlightened being somehow experiencing this religious stuff that has been put to one side?
Well, the problem with everything you've said is that I don't mean to be disrespectful, but the key words you used are all very fuzzy. Religion, spirituality, mystical, I admit I did use that word. And then enlightenment. All of these words really cry out to be more clearly defined. And if we don't do that, then I'm afraid we're at the risk of just using these ideas, which would sound very grand, without really quite knowing what we're talking about. And that's, I feel, one of the challenges in our time, is to find a discourse, a language, in which we, if we can talk about these things without using those words, any of the ones you just mentioned, in such a way that it communicates what seems to be really at stake in these questions, then you have to ask, well, why bother using those words at all? What do they add to the discussion? See, to me, the problem with the word God, for example, is it just doesn't work anymore. I'm not actually even interested in an argument as to whether God exists or not, because the word God just doesn't work for me. I don't know what the hell it means, really. And I think it's true even with some of these other terms. See, the word enlightened, I prefer, if I do use such a word, it would be awakening. And I can define that very precisely according to, again, the Buddha's first sermon. The Buddha's the working definition I would take for enlightenment, awakening, is the Buddha says, it was not until I had fully understood these four truths, in inverted commas, in all of their aspects, and that's referring to these four tasks, that I could consider myself to have achieved a peerless awakening in this world. So it's very clear. That's a very, very clear definition. An awakened person is one who is constantly engaged and has, to some extent, accomplished the task of these four truths. The trouble is, enlightenment gets thrown around to mean something like having some privileged, private, generally mystical experience of some transcendent reality. You hear people saying, is the Dalai Lama enlightened? Completely meaningless question. Because you have to ask, really, enlightened about what? And sometimes we use these, when words get used in this way, and the telltale sign is in English, when you capitalise the first letter. You always know something's fishy when you see that. Is that we tend to reify these terms as though they somehow stand for something that exists as sui generis, in and of its own right. And that's, I think, a great temptation within the discourse that we find in the religions, is the unjustified reification and privileging of key terms and giving them a sort of importance that prevents us from really having a critical understanding of what they mean. Yes, here. You, and then the lady behind. Yes, toi, two. You, standing up.
I'm going to have another go at the same question, actually, without using any words, or at least any of the kind mental work. As a scientist, I had to meditate 30 years ago only with religious groups, and I was able to rationalise why I was there. Then when the Oxford cognitive-based study, then I thought that would suit me more. My main point is that as a tool for doing anything, let's go into any of the problem words, as a tool for changing what people believe, improving what people believe, the secular route isn't as sharp in my experience as the other route.
What is the other
route? I'm having to come down to a word now. People, it's the other way around to your point. The point is that people do require a devotional aspect to their lives. And when I was meditating with a proper monk or a nun at the front now, then someone who perhaps worked 9 to 5 or just 9 to 1. It's so easy to get confused with all the iconic figure, a proper figure, and all that kind of thing. But people need it, don't they? Let's just stick to devotion. The devotional aspect won't go away because it's in people's hearts and minds. And I suppose we have to say that, looking at the large numbers of people, we're not all going to intellectualise and follow the secular route. We're going to require the devotional pathway in order to. But how could secular Buddhism survive without devotion?
Devotion. I would question whether people need, in a general sense, devotion. Some people do, clearly. But I don't, for myself, for example, I've never really felt that need very strongly. On the other hand, and I'm often asked this question, to me, sitting quietly for 30 minutes is an act of devotion. Just sitting on the floor or a chair, and being quiet and being totally open to life, to me carries with it an element of devotion. Not a devotion to a figure, not a devotion to some sort of higher truth, but a devotion to the sorts of values that are embodied in that act, which we've been talking about all day. But I think one of the differences that may characterize the practice of X, religion, let's say, in our times, is that we might become more aware that the form of practice that we assume will very often reflect our the particular temperament we have. And I think some of the typologies that Jung and others have worked out, I find are actually quite helpful. I think there are people who do seem to be wired in such a way that a practice of meditation or a practice to embody what really matters most to them, which in a way is what religion means, I think, at its best, requires or inevitably brings is a response to a need for a kind of an emotional devotional relationship. But other people who are typologically wired in a different way, whether that be more imaginative or whether it be thinking, that may not be a need any more than, you know, theology will be a need for someone who is more emotionally oriented. And I think we have to, I think the danger of any kind of term like secular is that it's going to reflect to some extent the biases of those who are drawn to that term. And in my case, I'm aware that I have a somewhat intellectual bias in these things, and I'm aware that the word secular carries some of that ring. And I'm not totally happy with it, frankly. I think all of these terms we're sort of toying with, secular, atheist, agnostic, humanist, they all seem to be trying to describe something that actually is greater than all of those particular labels. What Harvard University, there is a humanist chaplain and a humanist chaplaincy. And he invites atheists, agnostics, humanists, basically people who don't fit into any category of religion or who are not willing to self-identify with any religious label, who feel, who would more or less self-identify with some of those adjectives, that such people are really struggling and looking for a way of life that is intellectually coherent, is emotionally satisfying, is personally transformative, is ethically engaged, and yet they don't find outside the religions a model which meets that particular set of needs. And so I wouldn't get too attached to notions, the notion of secular, for example. It's one I'm finding quite useful. But largely in a somewhat rhetorical way. But obviously the needs that individual people will feel or will want to be satisfied are going to be very varied, and some of them will find secular leaves them totally cold. Like someone told me that the other day. We have time for one more question. Yes, at the back, Danielle. Sorry? The unconscious.
Embracing whatever's happening to you at the moment with honesty. And my question is, can you do that if you deny the existence of the unconscious? And can mindfulness reach the unconscious in your experience?
Well, again, I'm a little hesitant, as Jung was actually, to use the word unconscious as a noun, the unconscious, but rather to use it as I think it's meant, simply to refer to those parts of ourselves of which we are not conscious. Okay? Now, clearly, you cannot be mindful of something of which you are not conscious. If you could be mindful of it, you'd be conscious of it. So, I do think the Buddhist teaching in general has no difficulty acknowledging that there are large areas of our experience of which we are unconscious. And part of the training of mindfulness, therefore, is, as in psychotherapy, to become more conscious, to expand the extent of our being, our experience, into the domain of consciousness, becoming more conscious, becoming more mindful, more awake. So I don't think you have to hold on to, you know, a doctrine of the unconscious, but I don't find it really problematic that a practice of awareness, of mindfulness, will be a process of, as Freud said, making the id ego. In other words, what was previously just a sort of an unconscious drive, becoming more and more aware of that and integrating it into one's conscious life. So in that sense, I think the Buddhist meditation is in some respects quite similar to the process of psychoanalysis, psychotherapy, as at least would have been understood by Freud and Jung. The difference, of course, is it's not dealing with, you know, strictly pathological issues, but with what Jung would have called the individuation process itself, of becoming more fully aware of what it is that informs our lives, much of which we're not conscious of now. And we do have to stop here, I'm afraid. I'd love to continue this discussion, but James has told me in no uncertain terms that at this point we have to conclude, and James would like to just make a few final remarks. Do you want the mic?